My name is Ted Harbach, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm alive and sober tonight by the very special grace of a loving God and the loving program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Ken's legally blind, that's why he can't see me. So he thinks it's funny, I'd die. He just bumbles along and says, "Excuse me, I can't see you." Don't do that with a drink. Clancy just passed by and said hello to him, to me. He said he thought it would do good for my stature to be seen talking to him. I didn't think he'd showed up. He heard me speak about 15 years ago. He's been sober ever since. So. Thanks to the committee for asking me to come and speak here. It's always my great pleasure to speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because, you see, when I'm in front of in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm in the one place I'd rather be than anywhere in this world. And I want to thank Doug Stitt and his partner Joe for picking me up at the airport and kind of being my host. Those huckleberries were out at midnight last night, still fixing up fruit baskets for the speakers. It's funny that people would laugh at that. You know, if everybody kept commitments like that, there wouldn't be any reason for people to go out. See, there's about 5% of the people in this room that are active in putting this deal together. The rest of you are the audience, and I'm glad because that makes me feel good. Fills me with all that hope that maybe one of you will make it. Of course, Tony Daly, I mean, putting that first speaker on to get all that juice, I think that was... I thought this was principles before personalities. My sponsor's in the hospital, and I think he's dying of cancer, and he's a beautiful man. He's in... Inglewood Hospital, and he's got cancer of the throat. And that they've taken away the one thing that meant more to him nearly than anything, and that was his voice, because of the hundreds and hundreds of people that he sponsored. And his name's Luke Thomas, and I don't want to lose him, because he's been my sponsor since the beginning. And I thought for a long time he had a suicide complex, sponsoring me, because he was very unkind. I remember one time I called him. I was about 2 years sober, and I'd started a new business of my own, and I was having a lot of trouble, and I called him, and I said, "Damn it, all the people that I'm doing business with are just liars, cheaters, and thieves. They're just all on the con and all on the scam, and I'm going yabba dabba 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 dabba," and he says, "You done?" And I said, "Well, I guess so." He said, "Well, Dad," he said, "when you stop lying, cheating, and thieving, and when you stop being on the scam and on the con, you won't attract people like that anymore." I had a shell jacked in my .45 automatic. I was halfway out the front door when I realized some bitch might be right. And that's going to turn me into the same kind of loving sponsor. And I'm a big book man and a fundamentalist. If you call me, you better have three things in front of you. A big book, a pencil. They weigh 900 pounds, if you didn't know that. And a piece of paper. I was born an alcoholic. The reason I know that is the first thing my mother said was, "My God, you see how much he drank?" And my habits haven't changed much since. I can still get through a six-pack of Coca-Cola about as fast as I get through a six-pack of Cutty Sark. I was retarded, though. I didn't start drinking until I was around 16. I kind of envy these people that are starting so early these days. Four. My parents tried to get me started early, you know. When I was teething, they kept rubbing my gums with bourbon and saying, "Isn't that good?" I really agreed, but they cut me off. I just kept saying the same thing I've always said, more. Every drink tasted the same way, like more. And I don't know what happened. I sat down with some intimate friends to celebrate a birthday or something, and when I got up from the table, why, 23 or 4 years had gone by. I didn't intend for that to happen. I'm a blackout drinker. I don't know if you know what that is, but... So most of my story is hearsay. And they told me some incredible tales. I had it kind of backfire me on one night, though, being a blackout drinker. I was at this weird meeting we've got in Beverly Hills, just west of West Holly Weird. And I mean, you ought to go to this Friday night Rodeo meeting if you ever get out there. They got a program there for everybody. They've got one on and on for people that talk too much, and they... I mean, you'll find everybody there, gamblers and eager eaters and just members of Alaqueen. They're just something for everybody, man. And I like to go there about once a year. It just makes me feel so superior. I was sitting there one night not too long ago, and I was looking across the room at this outfit. I couldn't believe it. I, honest to God, his hair was spiked up like this in about 6-inch comb, you know? And he had, and his ears were green, and his cheeks were orange. And he had these earrings hanging all out of his cheeks and stuff. And I was looking at him, and he just, wow. And he had an outfit on you wouldn't believe. And finally he turned around and he said, "What are you looking at?" And I said, "I don't know." But I said, "I was a blackout drinker, and years ago, some friends of mine told me that one weekend I was babysitting this 3-foot-tall Amazon parrot, and I was just sitting here thinking maybe we were related." Some of you drank with parrots, too. They don't care what you talk about. Yeah, I was a blackout drinker and got me into some weird situations. I remember one night I was out drinking. I had the most fabulous time. And this bar that I was in was just magnificent. The bartender served triples without being asked. And the baby dolls, they all got real attractive before 10 o'clock even. And the dancing was just terrific. And when I got home the next morning, all I could remember was that there was some azure blue wallpaper behind the back bar mirror, and they had gold toilets. And so I kept going around town trying to find this place because I'd had such a fabulous time. And finally I walked into this one bar, and by God, there's the wallpaper. And I turned to the bartender, I felt so good, and I said, "Listen, I think I was in here a week or so ago, I had just a great time, but just to make sure, I want to ask you, do you have gold toilets?" And he turned and yelled at the band leader, and he said, "Hey, George, I think we found the drunk that peed in your tuba." And then you get here, and they tell you got to take an inventory. You know, when I drank, why, a magic thing happened to me that I have never heard described by a social drinker. Now, I don't believe social drinkers should be allowed to drink. I mean, they don't know a damn thing about it. They waste so much, and just when it starts to do what it's supposed to do, they quit. I had this secretary for a long time that was a social drinker, and we'd go out to lunch, And just before lunch, she always said the same thing. She'd say, "I think I'll have a glass of wine." And I'd say, "Why?" And she'd say, oh, don't start that again. And then she'd start drinking that damn wine, and she'd get down about halfway and quit. Make me crazy. I could just see it evaporating. I said, for God's sake, why don't you drink the rest of it? And she said, oh, my dear, no, if I did, I might get dizzy. I said, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll get a 20-ounce glass. We'll fill it full of fortified port wine. Slam that baby back. You'll go right through dizzy to fun. Now, I don't know about Kentucky, but we're having a desperate time out in California with that because they've now lowered the blood alcohol content for drunk drivers to 0.08. Can you believe that? That's a slice of rum cake. If you've heard people saying stupid things from the podiums before, just wait.
Oh, yes, I was in this restaurant one night, I'll never forget, and I had a slice of rum cake. My whole life flashed before me. Became unmanageable. And they sentenced me to A&A. And by God, I made a decision that first night. I'm never going to drink again as long as I live. And they won't.
Well, what would happen to me would start around lunchtime. And I knew when it was lunch because I'd be ready to sign something like this. And my pen would fly across the room. That's the flyaways. And I knew that if I didn't go to lunch now, I would fly across the room in 8 million pieces. Ain't anybody going to put me back together. And so sometimes lunch was very early. 6. Sometimes it was way late in the day, 12:05. But when the pen went, I went. You come into this bar, and I don't know about you people, but I keep track of the stupid things that people say. First question this bartender says is, would you like a drink? Oh, no, thank you. I'm into health. And this is my week for protein. I think I'll have a hard-boiled egg and a pickled pig's foot. You want to wring the guy's throat. Yes, I want a drink, and bring it in a hurry. Make it a triple, put it in an old-fashioned glass, leave out the ice, no onions, so there'll be about a 3/8 inch of freeboard in there so you won't drown this brain surgeon next to you. He's getting ready for an operation, and he's got his scalpel keeps flying across the sticking in the nurses. Finally, this bartender brings a drink, and through an ingenious system of geometric levers, you crank it into your face. You say your first 3 prayers of the day. God, I hope it stays down. God, I hope it works. God, I wish he'd get back. Finally, after an epoch passes, while he returns, and he says the second most stupid question in the world. Do you have time for another? You look at your watch, you gotta be cool. It's an alcoholic watch, it has only one hand on it. It hasn't moved. You say, yes, I have time for another, and hurry. And he brings out when you crank that thing down, and then this magic happens that I've never heard described by a social drink. All of a sudden, all the terror is just ripped out. Just ripped out. And that God hole with the wind blowing through it that only the alcoholic knows about, it kind of starts to heal over. And that ice cube with 8 million corners in it, it starts to kind of thaw out. And all of a sudden, you look at that hand that couldn't hold a pen a moment before, and it's as solid as a rock. And then you look at that perfectly synchronized reflection of yourself in the back bar mirror. Ah, Clint Eastwood, you devil. And then you look down at this brain surgeon, and you say, hey, what kind of a day are you having, craphead? And all of a sudden, why, all the sharp edges and the rough corners fall off of life. And the world is soft, and it's round, and it's smooth, and it's my pineapple. And right at that moment, I cross over a line into a land that I call the land of Someday I'll. Someday I'll get it together. Someday I'll make that big deal. But over there in that land of Someday I'll, with all the terror ripped out, for the first time in my life, I feel as good as, I measure up to, and I'm not, and I'm a part of, for the first time in my life. All of a sudden, I no longer feel like an alien on a foreign planet. Nobody has given me the brochure, because that's the way I felt all my life. And over there, with that blood alcohol at just the right level, see, I can do all of the things that I wanted to do, and go all the places I wanted to go, and be all the people I wanted to be. All I had to do was figure out who you wanted me to be and what you wanted me to say so you wouldn't throw me away. And I end up living my life in that chameleon-like, people-pleasing attitude, living my life for your expectations, real or imagined. But over there, in that land of Someday I'll, I, for the first time in my life, am comfortable in here where I live. And behind that alcohol, why, I can have a race car on the track when I was 16 years old behind a forged birth certificate, put it through a crash wall when I was 17 and fracture my spine, end up the next year in a hospital. The doctors tell me I'd never walk again as long as I live. You know, doctors don't know a damn thing. And they act so omnipotent, you know. I remember when my little daughter was going to have her tonsils taken out and I was having a little financial trouble in business, and I went to the doctor and I said, now, doc, I said, my daughter's the only one that I've got. And she's just real little, and she's real important. And so I want to know what kind of grade you got in tonsils. You may have gotten an A in appendix, but you might have flunked tonsil. And most of my business was doctors, and I just somehow, you know, wanted to get him. And he told me he'd gotten a pretty good grade in tonsils. And I said, well, now, how much is this operation going to cost? I want to know every dime, see, because I am really tight at this time as far as my budget is concerned. And he told me, and I looked at it, and I said, oh, doc, oh, you are high. You are high. I'm going to have to get some competitive quotes here. And we laughed. He cut 200 off of it. So a little over 2 years ago, I had another opportunity to do that. I was out in Riverside, and I had a heart attack. People weren't paying too much attention to me, and feeling a little sorry for myself out there in East Jesus and Plowed Ground. That place is nowhere, I tell you. And I went out there to build a big $3 million self-storage facility, and, well, that's another story, but... Well, I'll tell you, the guy stiffed me on a $25,000 bonus, and I got a little depressed, and things kind of deteriorated from there. And, see, our big book says this. Our big book says lack of power was our dilemma. And the reason for that is because we give it away so easily. See, just the moment before you become afraid, or the moment before you become angry, you give all the power away. The instant before you become guilty, you give all the power away to whichever it is that you're going to be afraid of or be angry at. And you give all the power away. And this doctor walked into my room in the hospital, and he sat down at the end of my bed, and he's a chief cardiac surgeon, the head of the cardiac unit at Riverside Community Hospital. And he folded his arms like this, and he folded his legs, and I knew the conversation was over. I know body language. He said, well, we've looked at all the tests, and we've looked at all the movies, and we've checked your physical and everything, and we've decided you're not a candidate for open heart surgery, and so we're not going to operate. And I said, really? I said, well, Why is that? He said, well, we decide you only have a 30% chance of survival. I said, what are my chances of survival without it? He said, well, you could live 2 weeks or maybe 2 years. I said, that's interesting. Is that all? He said, yeah, that's all. I said, do you mind if I say a few things? He said, no, I don't mind at all, Mr. Omnipotent. I said, well, first of all, Doc, I said, you may have gotten an A in appendix, but I think you flunked art. And I said, secondly, you don't even know how the game plays. I don't know what kind of gambling halls you grew up in, but you see, the way the game plays is you give me the odds and I make the decision whether to pass or play, not you. And I said, besides that, I said, a 30% chance of survival is damn near a sure thing from where I come from. And I said, you know, what I really need, Doc, is somebody with some balls and not some... I said, I don't need somebody that's covering his ass and hiding behind a bunch of diplomas. See, what I needed was a guy like you people when you make 12-step calls. Somebody out there in the trenches on the front line, see. So I said, you're dismissed. You could have heard his jaw hit the ground, man. I said, you're dismissed. You're out of here. And I checked myself out, AMA, against medical advice, and I went and found a couple of mechanics that could get the job done. And interestingly enough, these two guys come out of Loma Linda Heart Unit, one of the finest in the world, and the reason they were out of there was because Loma Linda got personalities before principles. And they were given most of their surgery to one surgeon. And they lost probably 10 of the finest surgeons in the world because they got personalities before principles. This guy looked at me and he said, well, we looked at all the tests, we checked your physical, we looked at all the movies, and he gave you about a 95% chance. I got to give you 5. I said, I got to keep 5% just for a back door. And I said, shoot and cut. And so they gave me a 6-way heart bypass. And that kind of aggravated me because later I found out you can have 8. One's good, more's better. So my life's pretty good. Pretty good. So when this doctor told me I'd never walk again as long as I lived, well, I had the same attitude. I just said, really? A year later, I walked into his office and I had a broken thumb. And he said, how'd you do that? And I said, well, I fell down. He said, how'd you fall? I said, well, I was doing 80 miles an hour in a downhill race on skis. And he fainted. Love to make doctors faint. Buying that alcohol, I was able to become a charter member of the Mount Baldy Ski Patrol, one of the most dangerous mountains in the world. Used to kill 6 people as regular as clockwork. Got 2 this year. It's right up out of Pomona in California, and it doesn't look dangerous at all because it's right off the main highway, and you can just look up there and see it. And those people don't know that if you miss a rope barricade at the top, you get an 8,000-foot free fall into Victorville. And social drinkers usually don't see that. They have a half a glass of wine and fly off the edge of the mountain. And all you hear these boobs say is, oops. Never hear an alcoholic say anything as dumb as that. Alcoholic just look back over this scarf kind of like, when it's a downhill race, I'm going for it. And we don't care what we're doing as long as it looks good. I was the only member of the ski patrol that wasn't thrown off for drinking. They thought I came that way. And if you got terminal acrophobia, fear of height, I can't get up, or used to be, I couldn't get up on top of a bar stool without a parachute in the backup. So, you know, how do you be heroic and climb up in those chairlifts and gondolas and drag people out and, you know, all that stuff? What you do is invent the drinking man's ski pole. And each one will hold a pint. And you fill that skeepful with Ron Rico Purple Label 157 proof rum, and you really don't care how high or how fast. And we had a terrific time. We had a terrific time skiing. God, I worked on a patrol for 20 years as a volunteer, weekends and holidays. And I also helped do the first article for Life magazine on scuba diving in 1948. And we didn't even know what scuba gear was. The word hadn't even been invented. Self-contained underwater diving apparatus and breathing apparatus. And what we were using was high-altitude bomber breathers, and we were changing the diaphragms. And it's terrifying under that water. I don't know if you've ever been 100 feet underwater and start running out of air, but it makes you nervous. And because there isn't a whole lot left down there. So we found out that if you take the same fuel that you ran the race car with, 200-proof pure grain alcohol, and you put a dish of it right in front of the intake manifold of the compressor and bubble the air through it, why, you can fill the tank with a great percentage of alcohol vapor. And you can stand on the deck of the ship, put that mouthpiece in your face, and get euphoria of the deep and not even get wet. And you just grin a lot. Get down about 100 feet, and one of those big groupers comes up to you. They got a smile painted on their face, and you say, "Hi there." You know. And they always wave back. You know. So here, have a blast of this. Go walk somewhere. You can breathe down there anyway by that time. Buying that alcohol, I learned how to fly planes off a little grass strip in Santa Monica called Cloverfield. It's now Santa Monica Airport. We were 16, 18 years old. We didn't give a damn about anybody or any place or anything, believe me. And Second World War was on, and we were all going to go die anyway. And we were flying biplanes. That's what we were going to take to war. And they used to think that we were the most thorough people in inspecting them, the pre-flight, inspecting the fabric on the airplanes. Because we get a ladder, really check out the top airfoil. And what we're doing was changing the numbers with athletic tape because they didn't like the way we flew. And right off the end of the runway in those days, why, they had Ocean Park and Venice Piers, and both of them had roller coasters on them. At the top of those roller coasters, they had little spindly 2x4s and a sign that said, "Don't stand up." And we'd roll over right off the end of the runway, turn over on the back, and we hit the top of those roller coasters about 6 feet in the air. And then they found out why they weren't supposed to stand up. And then we'd roll them to the right and go over Surfers Beach in Malibu. And if you've ever seen 100 macho surfers hiding under their surfboards, that was funny. And I didn't have a whole lot of trouble with my drinking. I just had a whole lot of fun, mainly. I broke a lot of hearts, and I broke a lot of cars, and I broke a lot of stuff, but I want to tell you that the investment was worth it. These people would say, "Well, my worst day sober is better than my best day drinking." Oh, dear. I don't think a guy like you ought to drink. Pass on you. You should go drink now. Before it gets any worse. Jesus. And I got too drunk driving arrests the whole time I drove, and I never drove without drinking. I always felt, if you're going to drive, drink. Face traffic with confidence. And I only got two drunk driving arrests, and both of them were bad breaks. And somebody over there had a bad break, too. You know about that. Well, the first one happened when I ran away from home to get married when I was about 30. And I knew a good thing when I had it. And they gave me a terrific stag party down on one of those yachts in Newport Beach, and they were serving my favorite drink that night, booze. And I overshot the mark because I always overshot the mark. And I developed a way of driving. By the time I was 24 years old, I was one of the youngest subdividers in Southern California. And I was building over 200 houses a year, and I was busy. And I learned how to drive and drink without having the alcohol in the driver's compartment, because I think that getting caught with a bottle in the cockpit is just tacky. And I learned this from a great friend of mine, and we both raced cars together, and so everything we had had a superheated engine in it. And one night we were going skiing, God, we got another newcomer. Yes. Two months old. Watch that rum with her teething. And we got about, he had a brand new Cadillac convertible with a real superheated engine in it, and we got about as far as Mulholland, which was 2 minutes away. We drove. And I'd forgotten my drinking and driving in passenger bottle. My booze was up on top of the car in the ski poles. And I said, you know, do you have anything to drink? And he said, certainly. He handed me this hose out from under the dashboard. And I said, what the hell's that? I want a drink, not an enema. And he said, well, he said, just put that little pipe in your mouth, dummy, and pull the windshield washer knob. He had the windshield washer pump connected to a gallon of scotch up forward of the radiator where it'd stay nice and cool. You haven't lived unless you've driven to Mammoth that way. Mammoth, we always liked to ski up there when the snow was bad. We had a reciprocity agreement in those days where we could ski in anywhere in the country and work on the patrol when the snow was bad in Southern California. And we usually picked Mammoth because that was about the maximum length of time we could stay awake. It was a 2/5 drive to Mammoth, any way you cut it. And this one particular night, we cleared Bishop, and we're just entering the timber line where the great big pines grow, and all of a sudden there's this terrific crash. I was about halfway asleep and kind of almost laying down on the seat, fortunately. And it's a tremendous crash, and I slid underneath the dashboard, and I finally got myself untangled and got back up, and I turned to my partner and said, what the hell was that? And he said, I don't know, it must have been a big branch or something. And the whole right side of the windshield was gone. I just snapped on my goggles and grabbed a hose and had another blast. And we got up there to Mammoth the next morning, and you fall out of the car because you can't walk, you know, but usually there's an Al-Anon that's been lurking in the snowbank. You ever notice how Al-Anons lurk? And she was well qualified. She had those large bosoms, and she gathered me up and kind of pressed me to her large bosoms and patted me on the head and said the magic Al-Anon words, there. And then she said an amazing thing. She looked at the car and she said, do you know there's a deer in the back seat? And I got my first real look at this brand new Cadillac. The right side of the bumper was gone. The whole right side of the car was gone. Lights, fender, the hood, the windshield. This great huge tear in the convertible top. And here in the back seat is sitting this little fork and horn buck. And I looked at him and I looked at her and I said, well, of course, he was tired of walking. And you know what she said? Oh. It's incredible. They'll believe anything. It's just wonderful. I'm looking for one. My life is so great now, I'm looking for a relationship to screw it up. And I think an untreated Al-Anon is be perfect for me now. I think I could handle that. And so anyway, she takes you into the warming up hut there, and you get tuned up on about a half a gallon of Grenache Rosé, and about 9 in the morning, you're at the top of the mountain, some fool's nailed a number to your chest, and you're entering a downhill race. Now, I got to tell you, with that kind of handicap, if you can clear those gates without wiping out all the spectators, passing a sobriety test is a cakewalk. I mean, I passed hundreds of them. I loved them. But when they don't give you a chance, I think it's a bad break. And this was long before, you know, better law enforcement through chemistry, which I think has taken a lot of the gamesmanship out of it. I mean, they can really get dumb cops now. So I left the stag party down in Newport Beach, and I was operating under a full load. And like I said, I was busy. I was building all these damn houses, and you're leaving at just the most important part. And, I mean, I had a two-way radio to talk to my, you know, in case I got an important call, and I had this dictaphone to dictate gibberish to my secretary, so keep her on her toes. And you got to tune the radio, and you smoke, you got to get rid of the ashes, and you got to watch the rearview mirror, and you have to keep one eye closed, you know, which lane is yours. You're busy. So I developed this way of driving where I just kind of tuck the phone under my head and lean on the door jamb like this. And that kind of handles all the problems, because the ashes kind of drool away, and the rearview mirror is right there, and you can dial up the mirror, the radio, and the hose is hanging out of the other side of your mouth in case you need a bracer now and then. And a little pepper-upper there. The only thing you've got to be careful of, and about half the people are leaning over like this, is you got to remember always that your lane is the one on the bottom. So I'm tooling along like this, and I'm a very prudent driver when I'm drunk. And I still don't to this day know why the cops stopped me. I was clear over on the right-hand side of the freeway there in the dirt, and minding my own business, going about 5 miles an hour. And when the gumball machine went on, why, you know, I just let off on the accelerator, and it stopped. And I looked up the officer, and I said, why did you stop me? And he had a real sense of humor. You know. He said, we don't allow people to make movies on the freeway. And we thought maybe you were filming a rerun of Wagon Train. And then he asked a trick question, which I really don't think is fair. He said, where do you live? I said, I don't know. You have my driver's license. And then he did something that I considered just completely not a part, shouldn't be a part of the game at all. He opened the door. And I fell out. It is very difficult to maintain one's composure lying on a dirt shoulder looking up at a 9-foot cop. I think this is the only time in my life I ever said anything as stupid as, oops. And I was beginning to get some weird speeding tickets, too. You know, you come to this program, they tell you it's an honest program, but we in AA, we know that lying works. I mean, think about it. I developed this way of handling my parents practically from the beginning, where they would say, where are you going tonight? And you say, nowhere. Hey, what are you going to do? Nothing. Who are you going out with? Nobody. You get home and they say, why are you so late? And you say, I don't remember. And if you stick with that, you're home free. So this one particular night, we were going duck hunting at Barrett Lake out of San Diego, and somehow we got on the Coronado Ferry. And I was drunker than hell, because I always was, and in a blackout. And all I remember is I came to, and there's a horn honking, and there's a green light flashing, and we're racing. And I only know three things to do in a case like that. You just ram the accelerator all the way through the firewall, slide your foot off the clutch, and hang on, baby. And when the red light came on, I said, did we win? And the police officer said, you bet you did. Said, sign here and press hard. There's three copies. So when I went to court, the judge said, you know, Mr. Harbach, I wish you'd explain to the members of this jury and the people of this court how you could possibly be going 87 miles an hour on the Coronado Ferry. I hold the world land speed record for Coronado Ferry. And I said, well, Your Honor, I'd like to submit into evidence this document that will stipulate that the character defect in my car that was the proximate cause of this disastrous incident has been corrected to the complete satisfaction of the Department of Motor Vehicles and the San Diego Police Department. And it's been determined by exhaustive examination that the whole problem was an accelerator that was defective, and that this has been corrected. And I can assure the court and the members of this jury that an occasion like this will never reoccur. Case dismissed. I mean, what can you do up against a valedictorian like that? My God. So lying really, really works. In the next 6502 that I got, drunk driving arrest, was in Glendale. It was seven years later, and it was just the same thing. I left this party about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I had to drive very fast to get home before I passed out. And I've been driving 100 miles an hour for an hour, and I figured I was fairly close to home. It's only 7 miles. When the police officer stopped me, I found out I was still in Glendale, and he opened the door, too. So I was having a lot of trouble with my drinking, and so I thought I'd go to a psychiatrist. So I went to this psychiatrist, and I wish you people would stop doing that. You people are the reason I've decided that psychiatrists have the highest suicide rate of any professional group known. And this guy says, Yeah, I went to him about this pen flying out of my hand. It was getting embarrassing and starting to cost a lot of money. And I was spending a lot of money at lunch, too, and wasn't drinking and wasn't eating. But the pen thing was really... He said, why are you nervous? Isn't that stupid? I said, it's $65 an hour. You're going to figure that out. He said, well, do you drink? And I said, yes, I'll have a scotch and water. I noticed a curious phenomenon with people that I talked to, like police officers and doctors and psychiatrists. Just a very short time after I would start talking to them, the veins in their head would start pulsing, you know. He said, well, that's not what I mean. He said, how much do you drink? I said, well, I'm not quite sure. How much do you have? He said, well, have you drank all your life? And I said, no, not yet. He said, well, were you breastfed or bottle fed? I said, I don't know, but I grew to love both. And he went through this long goddamn litany and asked me if I had dreams, and I used to sit up nights in bars thinking of dreams to talk to him the next morning. Finally, he pronounced me cured, and he said, now we're going to give you this little prescription of Librium here. This is before medical science discovered alcoholism is caused by a Valium deficiency. And he said, this will stop the pen from flying out of your hand, and don't operate any mechanical equipment while you're taking this. And I said, oh, you mean like backhoes and dump trucks and stuff? And he said, yeah, that's right. Didn't mention cars. And he said, as far as your modest drinking is concerned, well, you probably should go to ANA and look into that. And he handed me a bill, and I looked at it. Oh, $37,000, no big deal. And I cut him a reader there, and he called the bank and told him it wasn't any good, and he jumped out the window. He had no fear of heights. And he'd gotten plenty high smelling my breath, I'll tell you. So things were just not working out too well, so I thought one night I came home shortly after that, and I thought, well, I'm just going to kill myself. So I went upstairs and I took my .45 automatic out from underneath the bed, underneath the pillow. I kept it there because they were after me. And you don't have to be paranoid to know they're after you. And I qualified expert with a .45. I hit what I aim at, and I jacked a shell in the chamber, took dead aim between my eyes, and blew a $95 mirror off the wall. So I thought, well, this is beginning to really get frustrating. I think I'll go to ANA. And I'm an academic genius. I knew all about the disease of alcoholism and the deterioration of all the organs and all that crap, but it wasn't happening to me. And being of a superior physique, it was unlikely that it would happen. Especially when I was such a modest drinker. This is only drinking 2/5 a day. That's not a whole lot when you scatter it out over 24 hours. So I'd been to your dumb meetings. I used to come regularly about once every 2 years. And it was the same old crap. I heard the same crap today from the podiums, you know. And
in sharing meetings.
Oh, God. And a woman in a meeting not too long ago. I can't go to those meetings. She's bleeding like a broken lamb about some her goddamn cat eating her parrot. I said, why don't you get on your knees and thank God you've got an absolutely normal cat? Did just what it's supposed to do, eat birds. I said, who was the boob that let the parrot out of the cave? Oh. Anyway, I went to this dumb meeting and I found a... was born and raised in Beverly Hills. I'm a high-bottom, medium-low, middle-bottom drunk. And I have made appointments with lower companions. So I found this lower companion meeting somewhere in east of Beverly Hills where nobody would know me. And I went over there, and God, it was in the most dreary... And it was in a Quonset hut. One of those old prefab World War II things. And I walked in, and it was dark. And they had little tin dishes with candles in them like this. The treasurer had gotten drunk and run off with all the money, and he hadn't been able to pay the electric bill. And everybody was lined up around the room in these tin chairs. Those kind of give you hemorrhoids, you know. And they're a non-color. And old. And you all had your heads in your hands like this, and it's obvious your life was over. And you were all old. Jesus, some of you were 40. And there was a skinny broad up there talking. I didn't know she was there for a long time. She's turned sideways. Finally, she turned around, and I got a look at that, and I thought, my God, be like making love to a gunny sack full of antlers. And she had false teeth. And she's clacking away and drooling out of the corner of her mouth. And her name was Phoebe. Finally, she got to this real important part, and she said, if you want what we have, I thought, Jesus, honey, if you got anything, hang on to it. What's a stepper like me doing a dead-end outfit like this? And finally, she ended up, God, it just went droned on, and then everybody clapped. And they passed a tin plate to see if they get the lights turned back on. Somebody handed me a cup of coffee. You could have filled an ink pen with it. Some other boob handed me a donut. And I'd had a few drinks and I missed it and it hit my toe. It almost broke my toe. And you could have shot pool with it. And I'd noticed this rather fat man over in the corner, and they took me over and introduced me to him, and his name was Buford. Buford was the sponsor. And he had all these little people around him hanging onto his coat sleeves, you know. And I thought, well, he's so overweight, maybe he's intelligent. Got to make a lot of money to feed that. And I made a terrible mistake. I said, Buford? Tell me about this A&A. God, what a mistake. He unreeled his fat fist and put his finger in the middle of my chest. Pissed me off right away.
He says, well, if you got a problem with alcohol, you're in the right place.
I don't have a problem with alcohol. It's when I quit drinking, that's when my problems start. Living life in a hostile universe with no anesthesia.
He said, well, I tell you about A&A, you just don't drink, no matter what. Even if your ass falls off. Oh.
How many of you have heard that crap? Maybe they don't say that here. It's just all over Southern California. Like a plague. I've determined the people that say that can't even join AA. Because they're not powerless over alcohol. They can't take the first step. See, they got something in here that I don't have.
They just don't drink, no matter what.
Yeah, right. I said, listen, fat man. I said, you don't even know what an alcoholic is. See, an alcoholic, at least of my caliber, is a person who drinks, no matter what. And if you're sensitive like I am, easily embarrassed, I usually drink about 2 weeks before my ass fell off. I could kind of feel it loosening up there. And if it falls off and you're unprepared, it's ugly. I mean, you just got a back with a crack, you know. Imagine stroking down the street with nothing to drink and some Al-Anon says, hey, Ted, your ass fell off. You know.
Well, bring it along, honey. I might want to sit on it later.
And she will.
He says, well, he says, it's the first drink to get you drunk.
Well, maybe I am in the right place. What is it that you drink? See, I know what drink it is that gets me drunk. It's the second to the last one. If you're getting it done on the first one, Jack, I'm with you. First drink that gets you drunk. You never heard about a screaming white-out drunk with no alcohol, I guess. I've been in them and I've seen them. They don't tell you when you take that first drink either. Usually it's 3 months before you drink the alcohol. Usually starts with a resentment against a speaker. I'm not going back to that stupid meeting again.
If you ever find yourself becoming critical of anybody or anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, you're on your way out. Because with that criticism, you have given yourself permission to leave. That's the beginning.
He said, well, he said, you got to think the whole drink through. I said, oh, God, think the whole drink. I never thought about a drink my whole life. Wouldn't even stop in a bar if I thought they had one drink. What is this? He says, well, it's one day at a time. I said, well, maybe for you, all that visceral defense you got hanging out over your belt buckle. For me, I can last about a nanosecond. That's about it for me. Well, he says, it's easy, does it? I said, easy never did nothing. He said, well, it's live and let live. That's what it is. I said, listen, you get that goddamn finger out of my chest or I'm going to tell you about live and let live. I'll rip that damn arm off and wear your head out with it. I said, tell me this, old man. If you take away my alcohol, what are you going to give me? That'll rip out the terror. If you take away my alcohol, what are you going to give me that'll heal up that God hole and melt that ice cube? What are you going to give me that'll allow me to be as good as, measure up to, and be a part of? What are you going to give me, old man, that'll allow me to do the one thing I wanted to do all my life? Which is just step out easy. See, that's all I ever wanted to do. And alcohol allowed me to just step out easy, no matter what. I said, what are you going to give me, old man? See, I'm an odds-on player. If you can't give me something that's better than what I'm giving up, I'm going to have to pass. What are you going to give me to take its place? A bunch of trite, hackneyed cliches hanging on the musty, dusty walls of old beat-up Ilano clubs? That's what you're going to give me?
Don't drink, no matter what. That's what I'm going to take out on the bricks to deal with a hostile universe and eke out a living with the enemy. That's what you're going to give me? Oh, thank you, but no thank you. I can't exist with that. I can put banners and decals all over my car. And I can put little mottos all over my shirts. And they aren't going to help me live, old man. And if that's all you can give me, I'm going to have to pass. And I had to leave, and I had to run out in the string, because that's all he could give me. It was the stuff he'd heard. See, he'd never read a magic book called Alcoholics Anonymous. He did not know. And therefore, the admonition in the big book comes true, which says you cannot pass on that which you do not have. Make sure that your own house is in order. And so I had to run out my string. And my string finally ran out in the latter part of March of 1968 in St. John's Hospital in Santa Monica, where I died of the terminal progressive disease of alcoholism, which is also cunning, baffling, powerful, patient, and progressive. And I came out of my last blackout, and my doctor was looking down at me, and he was crying. I could tell because he was getting me all wet. They're so dramatic. Little veins on his head were jumping in and out. I said, "Why are you crying, Doc?" And he says, "'Cause, damn it, you've killed yourself." I said, "Really? What are we having, an out-of-body experience?" He said, "You're still just a smartass, aren't you?" "Yes." I said, "Well, what killed me, Doc?" And he said, "Booze." God, doesn't that just warm your heart? I said, "Well, it must be more than that." He said, "Well, yeah." He said, "You got it all now." I said, "What's that?" He said, "Well, you got alcoholic gastritis, cirrhosis of the liver, hemorrhagic pancreatitis. You got two ulcers that are hemorrhaging. You're bleeding from every opening in your body. Your blood pressure is 60 over 40. That's serene. You do not care when your blood pressure is 60 over 40. So we push 7 pints of your blood type and the bank's empty, and that's the end of that tune. And besides, I said, "Wow, is there more?" He said, "Yes. If you don't promise me you'll never drink again as long as you live, I won't even treat you." I promise. 10 days later, I was back out in the street and I was drunk again. He told me I had not to do that anymore. And I came off that last drunk crawling around the unfinished concrete basement of an old beat-up house hanging on the side of a cliff in Silver Lake, just a little bit northwest of downtown Los Angeles. And I pried my face loose from the blood and the vomit on that concrete floor from the night before. And I cried out to the God of my childhood in that prayer that only an alcoholic has reached his final bottom. Only an alcoholic who's taken the first step, which says we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost self that we were alcoholic. But this is the first step in recovery. And that's back in chapter 3. Fully concede. Total and absolute surrender. And I cried that prayer that only the alcoholic, in the desperation of terror and loneliness, who knows that it's absolutely hopeless, can make. And I said, "God help me." And I remembered a man that I'd talked to some time before, and I don't remember where he was or who he was, but I'd asked him for help, I remember. And he said, I asked him that question. I said, what are you going to give me? You know, you've told me all this wonderful stuff. And he started to read the promises to me in the magic book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know if you know how many promises there are in this book, and if you're thinking 12, why, you've shortchanged yourself one more time. Because in the first 164 pages of this magic book, I have found to date over 182 promises. And they've all come true for me. And if you don't believe me, why, read it.
182 promises. If you can top that, I'd like to hear from you. And I asked him that question. I said, well, yeah, but what are you going to give me to take its place? And I had been articulating a question that I believe is on page 153 of our magic book, where it says, do you have an adequate substitute? And the answer is a resounding 152. Yes, there is a substitute. And it is vastly more than that. Now, you have to remember that when this was written, the meetings were the program. That is no longer true. The meetings are now the fellowship and the society. And the only thing that's left of the program are those sponsors that know how to be a guide in the Magic Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't hear the program in most of the meetings today. So when they mentioned fellowship here, they were talking as much about the program. Yes, there is a substitute, and it's vastly more than that. It is the fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus we have found the fellowship, and so will you. And that, my friends, is a magic of a deal called Alcoholics Anonymous. This man also said, Ted, when you finally reach that bottom beneath which you cannot go, you can come home. And I knew what he meant. And so that night, it was April Fool's Day, which is a good day for me, of 1968, when I went to my first real meeting about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have not had a drink or mind-altering chemical since that day. And I went home to a little park on Roxbury in Beverly Hills where I grew up and used to play as a kid. And that's where I found those old-timers that walked the walk of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't pay too much attention to what people say. I watch how they walk. See, if I want to know a person, all I need to do is watch how he treats himself, how he treats others, how he treats the things that belong to him, how he treats animals. I'll know all I need to know about that human being. And he'll never have to say a word. Because I'll know that that's the way he'll treat me. And that's what I really want to know. And so I watched these guys walking through the things that I have had to walk through in 25 years of sobriety. Losing businesses, losing loved ones, getting sick from terminal diseases, going through all of the problems that we have in life. I saw them getting new relationships. And I believe this about relationships. I believe that if a relationship is to have a chance in this life, it has the greatest chance in the world if it is in the environment of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. What greater environment could you have than two people working their own program, taking their own steps whenever they need it, and not bringing the wreckage of the outside world into that relationship? I watched them getting new businesses and gaining back health. People that couldn't walk from peripheral neuritis caused by alcoholism. People blinded by the poison alcohol, able to see again. I saw all of these miracles. And I kept coming back. And through the years, why, I've become a guide in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. A guide is a person who has found out how this deal works by stepping on the bodies of those that didn't make it. And through the years, it's been my great privilege to share the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous across the United States and Canada with the people that I found to be the masters of the program, and it's from them that I've developed my method of sponsorship. I make a promise to everybody that I sponsor that if you are willing, I can move you from step one into
steps 9, 10, 11, and 12 in less than one day. And if you don't believe that, call me. One person in this audience will call. That's exactly the way the old-timers sponsored people. I had the privilege of speaking at Founders Day in Akron, Ohio, and I went to Dr. Bob's little house, and I went through the archives and talked to the old-timers, and I found out that's exactly the way Dr. Bob sponsored people. They would come to that little house in the morning, and when they would leave in the afternoon, they would be into steps 9, 10, 11, and 12. Bill Wilson himself, on page 13 of our big book, is it 13 or 25, took all 12 steps. They were then the six steps of the Oxford group, but they have not changed in substance. Page 13 of the big book. Took all 12 steps, with the exception of the actual writing of the inventory and the actual making of the amends physically, but he was ready. You read the stories in the back of the book, you'll see where those people were out making noise the second day. The noise of knocking on the doors and making amends. The way I sponsor people is that way. I look at sponsorship like, well, a number of years ago I went back to get my pilot's license again. And I went to a guy that was a pilot and I said, I'd like to get my license again. And he said, let's go flying. I said, wait a minute. And we ought to go to a book study on compass? And he said, well, no, it generally points north. I said, well, we probably ought to go to some discussion meetings on artificial horizon, shouldn't we? He said, no, just keep the brown side, keep the blue side up. I said, what if the brown side gets up? He said, let go and let God. Sounded like the program to me. See, the dihedral of the wings is situated in such a way geometrically that if I don't screw with it, the plane stays right side up. And we went out and we practiced all of the principles of aerodynamics. If we had just practiced right rudder, you'd have a different speaker here. And once again, we become familiar with how the instruments work in concert with the control surfaces and how the control surfaces react to the airstream. And we practiced them all. And shortly he said, it's time to solo. And I went and soloed. And shortly he said, it's time for your FAA exam. And I passed my FAA exam and I got my license. I ask you a question. What kind of a flight instructor would I have if I had to call a son bitch every day? Think about it. I call him once every 2 years for my biannual flight inspection. Or I call him when I get the brown side up a little bit irregularly. Well, what kind of an instructor would he have been? And what kind of student would I have been if I had not been able to put all those principles into practice? And so that's how I sponsor people, and I set them free. I think most people that are sponsoring people today are making cripples. They're making captives who can't make a decision.
I got to call my sponsor. I still think 2 and 2 is 5. Isn't it?
Well, what kind of deal is that? So you say, well, how do you get people through it that fast? Well, simply, I just turn to page 60 and I ask them, are you believe in the ABCs here? A, that we are powerless over alcohol, or otherwise our manual. B, that no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God couldn't win if he were silent. Now, if they say no, I make them go back and read the first 4 chapters plus a doctor's opinion until they become convinced. They're still not convinced, I do what the book says. I tell them, go get drunk. That's what it says. Try it a few times. Try controlled drinking. Try stopping it. I'm a big book man. Finally, they become convinced of those three ideas. Next sentence says, being convinced we're at step 3. That's it. I hear about all this writing, step 1, and all this crap that came from treatment centers and spin dries and... fluff and fold. Yes, he's ready for life again. I spoke in Wisconsin not too long ago at a gratitude dinner, Emory, Wisconsin. That's right around the corner from Hazleton. And, of course, everybody gets back there, they got to take you over to Hazleton. That's their big deal. It looks like a goddamn country club. There's that newcomer. And they got this big director there, and they introduced me to him, and I said, you know, I said, that's really an inventory that you have the people take before they graduate. I don't know if you've seen, it's about 200 questions. If I'd seen that thing when I was new, I'd have never joined. Not another test. Yeah, I love the 20 questions, however. I only got one wrong. It said, does drinking interfere with your sleeping? I put, no. And my sponsor, that loving man, said, Ted, passed out is not sleeping. So with a little help, I got 100%. Anyway, this director there at Hazleton, his little chest started to puff out. I said, let me ask you, Mr. Director, how many promises are connected to your inventory? He says, what do you mean? I said, wasn't I clear? How many promises come true for me if I take the inventory your way? He says, well, I don't understand what you mean. I said, have you read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? He says, yes. I said, no, you haven't. There's 22 promises directly connected with the inventory if I take it the way it says in the big book. Steps 4 and 5. I said, you come up with more promises than my big book has, I'll take it your way. Meanwhile, I'll stick with the big book. Being convinced we're at step 3, turn the page over, there's a prayer for step 3. I do it on the phone, get both on our knees, says do it with somebody else, we do the prayer. That's the end of that. Nowhere in my book does it say we do step 3 over and over. People would stand up at these podiums and say, well, I do step 1, 2, and 3 every day. Kind of sounds so good. What they've told you is they're getting ready to start to commence to begin. They haven't done nothing. I wish the people in California would take their driver's test that way. Wake up one morning and say, you know, I've decided that my life is unmanageable without a driver's license, and I'm really a driver. I know that. And I think a power greater than myself called the Department of Motor Vehicles could return me to sanity here. That's kind of step 2. Then, by God, every morning they'd make a decision to go down there to the DMV and take that test. They'd never go. God forbid they'd go down there and do step 4, which is kind of a little inventory on your ability to drive there, a little written test. God forbid they'd do step 5, which kind of share it with the examiner there and see if you passed it. God help that they ask God in step 6 to become willing to ask God in step 6 to help them pass, or that they'd actually ask him in step 7. But by God, every morning they make a decision to keep taking the bus. And I'd have all the freeways to myself. Where does this nonsense, what book are they reading? Right after step 3 it says, though our decision in step 3 was a vital and necessary one, which means it's kind of important, it would have little lasting effect, which is sort of zero, unless followed at once. Now that's a difficult couplet. See, that means now. Yet you hear these people say, oh, I don't think you should take your inventory yet. You've only been around 4 years, and it might hurt your little feelings there and get drunky poo. So 10 minutes after they've been talking to me, they got a 900-pound pencil in their hand. And my sponsor told me to get a crayon so I wouldn't stab myself to death. I said, I too have to wait for the appropriate setting for this. I'm going to wait for an 8-day Easter weekend to get a chateau at Lake Arrowhead overlooking the lake there and sit down with a word processor with a spelling program in it and write the valedictorian of my career. He says, you're going to get a roll of toilet paper and a crayon and do what I tell you to do.
Well, that's not any fun.
So have some fun with it. The book says you just make 3 lists. A list of everybody you're pissed off at. How long is that going to take? If it takes you over 7 minutes, you're using your imagination. Just a quick list of everybody you're angry at. It's called resentments. Then you make a list of everything you're afraid of. And then you make a list, and I combine step four with step eight. Make a list of everybody that you've damaged, physically, mentally, morally, emotionally, socially, financially, or sexually. Make a list of them. And then you go back after you've made the list, because now you got an outline, you write a couple of sentences about each one.
I'm angry at my mommy because she put me on the potty backwards.
Everybody's mother puts them on the potty backwards. It's because they're sick. They want to watch. And anything to do with your drinking, you puke. Cross that out. Yeah. And then you write a couple of sentences about why you're afraid. And then in the third list, you write a couple of sentences about what happened. I still insist to my sponsor, this is where small farm animals get into the inventory. Next door neighbor's kids and mommy and daddy. I still insist to my sponsor that I was just helping the goat over the fence. Most people don't even know how to make love to a goat anyway. On their back, it's easier to kiss them that way. Have some fun with the damn thing. You know? And I don't just sit there and let them read it. I stop them at each individual point and we solve the problem there. And in the big book or from my personal experiences, I give them an answer as to how to solve that problem. What to do with that anger. What to do about that fear. And how to solve the problem of who they've harmed. And be very careful of those amends, because I want to tell you that honesty without compassion is brutality. Be very careful. Sharing guilt is not making an amend. And then after you finish reading that to your sponsor, I come home and turn to the most important page in the entire book as far as I'm concerned, page 75. On page 75, there are 10 promises, and it's the beginning of the whole deal, and I almost missed it. People say, where's the spiritual side of the program? Where do you get rid of the obsession to drink? Blah, 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 blah. Read the book, do the inventory, take the steps. On page 75 it says, we are preparing an arch through which we'll walk a free person. Free. I'm free today to do the things that I have to do because I want to do them. And there isn't anything I have to do if I don't want to do it. I don't even have to go to the bathroom if I don't want to. I can just stand here and let it happen. Of course, there's an admonition. I have to be responsible for my behavior. I can do anything in this world that I want to, as long as I'm willing to pay the price. Anything in the world. I got to look at the price. Burning arch through which you walk a free person. All fears will fall away. All fears will fall away. Now, you won't know that until sometime later on you screw up the courage to try and do the one thing that absolutely terrified you and find out that due to a magic deal called Alcoholics Anonymous and a power greater than yourself, the fear is gone. 7 years on this program, I was at an AA party on the top of a penthouse in Century City, and they had a little patio outside, and all of a sudden I was out there, and I felt this feeling that we get according to step 11, which says our intuition begins to become operative in our life. And I was directed to go over and do something I'd never been able to do in my entire life. And I looked straight down over the side of that parapet, 26 stories, and realized in one glorious instant all fear of height had been removed. And I didn't believe it, so I dropped up on the parapet and walked around a little bit. Now I realized that I could return to the mountains of my childhood, and I could climb into those gondolas and those chairlifts without any fear of height, without taking any mind-altering chemicals or drinking any alcohol of any kind. Only now I could take my little daughter. My little daughter is sober 22 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's no big deal. She's only 22. And I am the envy of every father in the world when I give you this line. My daughter signs her cards to me by saying, Daddy, I love you from the bottom of my heart because you are my very, very best friend. Wow, what a gift. What a fringe benefit of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous.